unlike Rav Shimon Shua Fuller here, who had a vision, had a dream, had a blueprint, if you're familiar with him, the collected writings, magnificent essays on Jewish education, Yeshiva University evolved. There was no blueprint, there was no plan. It's an amazing story. It goes back to 1886. Now we have to understand what happened in America. Who heard about America? The first Jews to arrive in America were Spanish Portuguese from Holland. Afterwards you have Germans before the Civil War. By the time of the Civil War, the whole world is focused on what's happening in America. Cousins are fighting over slavery. And suddenly, even in Eastern Europe, they were talking about the United States. When the Civil War ended by the 1870s, the Polish Jews stopped coming. By the 1880s, the White Russians, the Lithuanians, look at the map of Europe, and you can actually trace the emigration to the United States the closer you are. Germany, Western Europe, the first. Central Europe afterwards, and finally Eastern Europe. Well, they come to America. The assimilation is rampant. Hutchins Hapgood, I don't know if that name means anything to you, he was an Ohev Yisrael, a non-Jew, who did a major work about 120 years ago. He researched the Jews on the East Side. And he tells one story that captures it so beautiful. He describes this patriarchal Jew with a long beard saying to his American kid, "You're coming with me to Daven Marev? You come with me to Daven Marev?" And the kid answers, "What you giving me?" If his father gives him a nickel, he'll go Daven Marev. Without a nickel, ain't they in the dictionary, but he ain't Daven Marev. And that's America. Jews were very upset, and they couldn't understand why they are failing so in the United States. They looked to England, and England had a chief rabbinate, but Nassim Adler, Talmud of the Chatam Sofer, and the Jews on the east side of New York held a little meeting. "We need a chief rabbinate in America." They started looking around. This is already the end of the 1870s. Machlokes galore, as is the want with Jews. And finally, they invited the Malbim, the great Malbim, who happened to have a doctorate, I'm told, invited him to America. He would have been perfect. No one can question the Malbim's learning, and he was open to Western culture. He died on the way to America, 1879. I believe it was in Bucharest. You can check it out. He died on the way to the boat. Again, it got involved in great machloket, and finally they settled on a Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the Vilna Shtok Magid, the Vilna preacher, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, known throughout the Torah community in America as RJJ, Rabbi Jacob Joseph. 1887, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef arrives in America at the boat docks on Shabbat in Hoboken, New Jersey. After Shabbos, 120 horse-drawn carriages go from the east side, every shul, every balabas, to meet the chief rabbi. If there ever was a tragedy in America, it was the Rabbi Jacob Joseph tragedy. Within a few years, the man was completely compromised. There were about six, seven other chief rabbis. They asked one Jew who put up a sign, the Mosque of a Rav, Rabinovitz, chief rabbi of the United States. They asked him, "Who made you chief rabbi?" The sign painter. And it was a tremendous failure. It's been analyzed. There's been a good deal of scholarship on it. You see, a chief rabbinate can succeed in England because you have a chum. think for a minute to the modern mind, royalty, a queen. And the queen has survived. Her family has turned into a paper place these last 20 years. I know that the good Lord told me we were quite friendly. Your chief rabbi, Lord Emmanuel, chief rabbi Jacobowitz. The good Lord told me one morning after davening, when he tried to come in Aliyah and lived on Gedudah Breed, it's very hard after being a chief rabbi to walk into a shul where they correct your Hebrew. I once heard him speak in my shul, and the Chalel is there correcting his Hebrew from the audience. I was fit to be tied. Man, give him credit, he's speaking Hebrew. I live in Israel 41 years, all right, I never speak Hebrew. Wow. So he told me when the queen hosted him the final Shabbat as chief rabbi in Buckingham Palace, kosher caterer, he explains to her Nechilat Yadayim, next Kiddush, the Yekka custom, Hamotzi, and then the meal begins. And he was briefed beforehand by protocol that you don't start talking to the queen. She talks to you, and she will raise the topic she wants to speak about. Do you know why the queen questioned him? Do I have to tell you? And a little brunch boy from Yerushalayim has to tell you, sitting in the heart of Her Majesty's country, she says to him, Rabbi Jacobowitz, or Lord Jacobowitz, why is it you succeeded with your children and I failed? And never the quote, end quote. Nevertheless, you have a chief rabbi here, you have a queen, you have monarchy, you're conservative with a small city. The royal mail, the royal post office, the royal hat maker. In America, they'd laugh you, president, all right, peanut farmers. You understand, who do we have? Movie actors, Ronald Reagan. All right, I don't want to talk about the present one because he has to prove his mettle yet, but when I look at Tiger Woods, somehow I see Hussein Obama. So the chief rabbinate's there. But a few Jews on the east side got together in 1886, and they organized the day school. It was not the first day school in America, but the first one that caught on. Eitz Chaim. Well, a day school is important. You go to yeshiva for 8 years, but then you go to high school. I spoke about my mother-in-law last night. So my mother-in-law, Zichron Tzadeket Levracha, always told the story how her parents spoke Yiddish. Although she was born in America, she heard a lot of Yiddish in her home. And one time in public school, she used the word kalenda instead of saying calendar. And everyone laughed at her. It left a scar on her. So you do 8 years of elementary school, go on to high school, secular, you're swept away. By 1897, a group of people got together with a rabbi, Maklin, and they asked him to teach the high school kids Gemara. Let them continue some sort of Torah education. And he organized in a shul, the Marion Pohl shul on the east side, he organized a class for his son Akiva, who later becomes a famous medical doctor, and his son's friends. I had the same thing, the grandson and grandchildren in Yeshiva HaKotel. I had many yeshivas, but Yeshiva HaKotel. So one grandson asked me to come and give his shiur once a week. So I thought it's only for him. Lo and behold, it's for him, it's for his friends. And each week there's a bigger crowd of the finest youth in the world. So Rabbi Maklin began, and he named the yeshiva, who died in 1896, one of the greatest, most famous Lithuanian rabbis, Rabbi Isaac Elchanan. So he named the yeshiva after the Kavner Rav. He named the study group Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. So you now had Eitz Chaim, and you had a post elementary school program that was starting to gain students. By 1900, if you look at the figures, hundreds of thousands of Jews, mainly East European, including, that's why I'm alive today, including my grandparents on all sides are pouring into America. And now you have yeshiva people coming in from Europe. Well, they're greenhorns. They don't speak English yet. For a year or two, they need a buffer zone. When I went in Aliyah, we went into an absorption center. In those days, they were Merkazei Klita. So my first address in Israel was the Katamon Tet Absorption Center in Jerusalem. I went into the yeshiva, sat down and learned, felt at home, and a whole group was gathering. By 1906, 1907, and all this is documented. I'll tell you who, Jerry, you know who did a doctorate on this? I stood on his shoulders in my doctorate, Gil Clapham. Gil Clapham's doctorate covers the Rabbi Dr. Gil Clapham's rabbi of Bet Shalom in Lawrence, which today is one of the powerful shoes on the Torah scene in the New York area. And he did a doctorate on the history of yeshiva, 1886 to 1915. The students started to clamor, we want a high school. The Europäische, they said, we're coming to America, we can't learn English, we need a high school, we need a bit of education. The youngest students coming out of Beitz Chaim said, why do we have to go to a Goyishe school, we want a high school. The Baba Batin, who ran the yeshiva, told the students, America is good enough for us with our broken English. We still make a little bit money here. What do you need a high school for? A yeshiva is to learn and not for nourishment. And there were student strikes, and the Baba Batin refused to open a high school. There were strikes in 1907, 1908, 1909, 1910, and they got nowhere. Some of the rabbis were more forward-looking, what you call proactive, than the wealthy Baba Batin, who were salesmen, were in real estate, had stores. They were right, but they had broken English. They made a lot of money, and they became big shots, and this is what America is all about. Some of the rabbis had greater vision, particularly a Rabbi Leventhal from Philadelphia. And they decided we must open a high school, but we need the right man. And here there is an unbelievable story. There was a small little city, or town, a dorf, I should say, outside of Kupna. It was called Pren. The Pren Rav was what Nachum Shraga Revo. The Prenner Rav had a brilliant son named Dov. When Dov was 12, his father died. So Dov basically was autodidactic. He raised himself. He sat in the Batei Medrash in Kovna. He went to Tells for one semester. And then he became a Buddhist. Now, let me explain. I did a lot of research on this, and I actually found the newspapers from 1905 in Russia, in the Yivo in New York, and this. That itself is an unbelievable story of what happened to me during my research, and the old Jewish communists who wanted to choke me in the library because I was wearing a kippah. It brought out the hatred indescribable. Besides that, we managed. Amaro became a Buddhist. Did he break with religion? I don't know. What is a Buddhist, first of all? The Buddhist was the Jewish socialist. Many of them became communist. Many of them became anarchist. I spoke with old-timers who told me, if you were not a Buddhist, you had no youth. The dream, the vision. Communism is fabulous. There are inherent problems with our capitalist system. He is a man. He goes to a doctor. He's impoverished. He has to, I don't know what's going on, let me not comment, but in Israel, goes to the Kupat Kolim, has to wait in line. Here's a gentleman who has $2 billion in the bank. Calls the doctor, professor comes running. He walks into an office. The minute you walk in, they put a meter on your nose, and every minute you're in there taking oxygen away from the professor, they charge you $100. Why does he care? So he's in there for 20 minutes. Is that fair? Here's a man who has 10 children. Here's a man who has one. Tremendous inherent problems. I mean, this makes a lot of sense. The fact that they later don't believe in God, hate religion, shoot you, the individual means absolutely nothing. Trotsky, take him to the wall. Stalin, how many did he murder? They say he murdered more Russians than Hitler. Than Hitler murdered in World War II. But the communism was a dream. Beautiful. A lot of writings come from yeshiva boys who spoke and saved by Yikron and how you deal with when you sell your property and how you can redeem it. This is socialist ideas. Well, the Tsar didn't like it. And in 1905, there was an attempt on his life, crackdown on the communist, Buddhist, socialists, anarchists in the Kovno area, and Bernard Revel winds up in jail. Gets out of jail. He now has a half-brother in America. That half-brother, by the way, in parentheses, is the father of Nelson Glick. Mean anything to you? Professor Nelson Glick, president of Hebrew Union College, the Reform Movement, was a nephew to Rabbi Revel. This is America. When he got divorced, Rabbi Revel pleaded with him to give his wife a get, that she shouldn't remarry and have Mamzerim. Revel comes to America. Could you imagine, 1905, he crosses the ocean, comes to America, a greenhorn. His father is dead, his mother may be gone already, or left behind in Europe. A half-brother, some other distant relatives. Could you imagine if someone stopped him in Ellis Island and said to him, Reb Dov, I want you to know that in 1986, the American government is going to issue a $1 stamp with your face on it. Could you imagine? He would have said, what are you, crazy? You sugar? Why are you telling me such things for? Impossible. 1986, it's a beautiful orange stamp. Do you remember the scandal about the stamp? You don't remember. They found in the stamp that the artist who was Jewish and commissioned by the United States Post Office put a mug and dub it in his beard. And there was an outcry, you understand? The poor guy, he put a mug and dub it in. Someone noticed it, and they kind of saw it. He put it in on purpose. But it's a beautiful, beautiful stamp. Bernard Revel comes in, goes to the yeshiva. Rabbi Leventhal of Philadelphia comes to visit once a week. He was the president of the yeshiva. He was a rabbi, Yerupesha, a student of Shulchan Inspector. Rabbi Dov Aryeh Cohen Leventhal, or Bernard in English. He meets this Bernard Revel, and he sees a photographic memory. Every post up in Shas by heart. I know this from my witnesses, ear witnesses. He says, you're wasting your time. There's nothing you can learn here. Come to Philadelphia, be my assistant, and go to university. You have to get a degree. Rabbi Revel goes on to become the first PhD graduate of Dropsy College. Dropsy College today no longer exists. It's part of the University of Pennsylvania. But it was an advanced postgraduate school for the scientific study. What we spoke about 2 nights ago of Jewish texts. He does a doctorate on the halakhic traditions, the Sadducean tradition, the Philonian tradition, and the halakha. Fascinating doctorate. 1909, Reb Moshe Bick. I don't know if that means anything to you, Jerry, and Hunter.
From the Bronx.
You got it. Nope, Reb Moshe Bick told me this was the Rav of the Bronx. Reb Moshe Bick told me, this was the first shidduch made in America. What happened? There was a Rabbi Zivitz in Pittsburgh. Rabbi Zivitz in Pittsburgh, Reb Shimon Binyamin Zivitz, used to travel occasionally to Marietta, Ohio. And it's mind-boggling, the Hashgacha Pratim. They couldn't afford a rabbi, but he would come every few months, take the train, and go from Pittsburgh to Marietta, Ohio. He would paskin their shilas, whatever had to be done, he was their rabbi long distance. Comes to Marietta, there's a wealthy family there in the petroleum, the oil industry, Travis. And they have a daughter, Chaya Sarah Travis. And she's a very firm girl, 19 years of age. They need a shidduch. Rabbi Zibitz gets in touch with Rabbi Leventhal. You told me you had this young man, a chofem al shidduch. Rabbi Rebel, Thanksgiving Day, 1908, comes out to Marietta, Ohio. They get engaged. In June of 1909, they marry. Out of that shidduch is born Yeshiva University. I had the privilege to teach in the Kollel the great-grandson of the Muscat family of Marietta, Ohio, that brought Rabbi Zibitz into the picture and made the shidduch with Sarah Travis Revel. He goes into the family business. What does he need? Anything else? Petroleum, oil, Tulsa, Oklahoma, goes out to the oil fields. Mrs. Revel told me all this. Went out to the oil fields 5 o'clock in the morning because it's too hot. By 12 o'clock he was home. You can't work in the middle of the day. And he's learning and writing Kiddushei Torah. And everyone in New York knows about this legendary figure working in Tulsa, Talmud Chacham, PhD, 1915, they come to him, we need you in New York to organize a high school. And Rabbi Revel makes a condition. You just think now, compared to the scandals we have in America today with money, I just told someone, if you're up to date with this Lakewood boy who ripped off $150 million, the person he took $79 million from ripped him off. Happens to be someone I know more than 60 years. Azad Pyra and Shoma. It hurts. His wife had just died. His mother had just died. This Chanaz took care of him. Unlike what goes on today, Rabbi Revel made one condition. He takes no salary. His family will support him. And in 1915, where did you go to school, Jerry? High school.
That's here.
Tell the audience what you're talking about. Say it with pride. Talmudical Academy. At that time, there were two branches, Manhattan and Brooklyn, so he said MTA. Today, it's TA again. They're no longer two branches. Brooklyn can't tolerate a YU institution. No, that's the truth. They had to get out. There's only one branch, Uptown, TA. I'm a Talmudical Academy graduate. What a school. 1915. To be pedantic, it opened its doors January 1916. And for the first time, you had a full high school education approved by the state of New York, the Board of Education, under the auspices of Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. Did more than that. America's America. We need Rabbanim. He introduced a more formal course leading to Smicha. Introduced courses in elocution. The students should know homiletics. In 1919, the first 5 students educated in America, not in Europe, received Smicha. One of them was American-born, Saul B. Friedman, who I yet knew. And he was the center of attention, a lawyer, American-born. Smicha. And Rabbi Revel danced with them at the Chag HaSmicha, singing his favorite song, V'Tarheli Beinu Liyotach HaBinanet. But he did more than that. And frankly, on September 1st, I drink a l'chaim in memory of Rabbi Revel because he changed the course of America. and you did what no one else did, changed everything. What do I mean? You get plenty of great Rabbanim coming here. I was in America, last winter, so when I came back, the other members of the Grist faculty said, you're the only rabbi who came back smiling from America. What did he mean? Everyone else went to raise money. You know, you tried raising money with the situation in America, what it was a year ago, and at the height of the Madoff scandal. Even Rabbi Riskin came back with his face on the floor. I went to teach Torah, and what can be bad teaching Torah? So many great Rabbanim came to America, but they came to America to raise money. They had a drasha here, a drasha there, raised money for the good causes, the European yeshiva, and then they went back. Everyone left that yeshiva's Biskol Chanan called Dritz, Rabbi Isaac Ochanan Theological Seminary, it's the acronym. Everyone left the Dritz. Ah, what kind of yeshiva is this? Europe has great yeshiva. Europe has great Rabbanim, great Rashi Yeshiva. Who's teaching here? And the truth of the matter is, what makes a school great? The faculty. No one comes to Gris Kollel because we have the Hilton for a dormitory. Or Blooms for catering, if I'm hitting the nail on the head. They tell me if I'm in England and haven't eaten the salted beef, I'm lacking. So far, I've not tasted the salted beef, but I don't know whether I'm lacking or not. The Rashi Yeshiva. Rabbi Revel turned to Europe and he got what arguably the greatest Talmud Rabbi in Briska to come to America. Who are we talking about? Rav Shlomo Palachek, the Meitzer to Eloy. Now, the Meitzer to Eloy, and I've written about him, you can read about him in volume one of Rakafadar and get a monograph on him. I know the family is all. Again, no one will go sideways now. Why did the Meitzer to come to America? Because Nishva Canaan, the draft. Shouldn't happen to anyone. He became a Mizrahiite. Became a religious Zionist. And very uncomfortable in Europe. His colleagues from Goloshen were angry at him. Everyone was running to Agudat Yisrael. And the Meitzer taught in the Mizrahi Yeshiva in Lida. You're familiar with it, Rabbi Reines' Yeshiva, Torah Vadat. The Meitzer taught there, World War I ended it. He was looking where to go, taught in the Tachkamoni in the Yalistok, and he accepted the invitation. The Meitzer is coming to America, changed the entire status level of Torah study in America. The newspapers couldn't believe it. There was a reunion of the yeshivas, graduates, the rabbis, and the reporter for one of the Yiddish newspapers in New York. There were four at the time, five at the time, dailies. The reporter described an amazing sight, the table set with magnificent food, and no one is eating. All the Bacharim are gathered around the Meitzer and the Rebbe Zain learning. He's talking and learning in a Sugyin Yavamot. And until the Meitzer finished, no one touched a morsel of food. And the person writes, he never saw such respect in his life. American kids, the food didn't interest them. The Meitzer is the first. Because the Meitzer came, when he passed on, Rabbi Revel was heartbroken, but he looked to Europe and he brought Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik. Why did Rabbi Moshe have to leave Europe? Shouldn't happen to anyone. He too became a shtickel, a Mizrahiite. And what he wasn't, his wife was. And she knew where the future was. Once Rabbi Moshe came, where did the Rav go in 32? To America. The rest is history. But more than that is happening. You now have a high school. You see, there's no master plan. My parents had a master plan. No, here, yeshiva, a high school, a more formal smicha program, and then the students started clamoring. We want a college. To quote Rabbi Revel, the organization of Yeshiva College was the natural outgrowth of Talmudical Academy. If we give them high school and yeshiva under one roof, why don't we give them college and yeshiva? Why do they have to go to Columbia University and the City College of New York, which was then a top college with the top professors? Do it under one roof. And the yeshiva announced a $5 million campaign to build a campus way uptown. If you know New York, the sign is near the Statue of Liberty, right near the river, right near the ocean. Uptown, Washington Heights, farmland at the time. And yeshiva bought, three individuals gave $100,000 to the yeshiva. Harry Fisher, I had the script that I taught his great-grandson in Dakota. It's my bottom. Harry Fisher, Nathan Lamport, Mendel Gottesman. Remember, they were Gottesman fellows. You're looking at one. I used to, once a year in his yahrzeit, we would have a dinner and say the great Torah in his memory with his son, Benjamin Gottesman. Baruch Hashem, I can take off my sweater. A miracle is happening. It's warming up here. Oh, well, then I'll suffer. The Yeshiva College opens, beautiful campus. They say when Rabbi Herzog saw the campus in 41 of Yeshiva University College for the first time, he cried at such a beautiful building. It's like a Moorish temple. It's practically, it's an entire block on one side, on the other side it goes back a half a block on the part on this side, even longer than a half a block. What a magnificent structure. The turrets, the top part, were covered with real gold. That's the way they built it. We have arrived. But we Jews have no mazel. It's an open gemara, ein mazal in Israel. The yeshiva opens in 29. Millions of dollars have to be collected in pledges by later that year. The pledges aren't worth the paper they are written on. The stock market crashes. Yeshiva survives only by miracles. Now, my rebel's health is shattered. He dies December 2nd. Bet Kislev, it worked out, 1940. Yeshiva has a second tragedy. January 31st, 1941, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik dies. And now a tremendous war breaks out. Who will become the next president of the yeshiva? Rabbi Belkin, we spoke about this Saturday night. Rabbi Shmuel Belkin, who came to America at the age of 17, 1928, from absolute poverty. His father was executed by a gunman before his eyes in some of the inner fighting with the communists, the Reds versus the whites in white Russia. The man was so poor that when he learned in Mir, he and Rabbi Shimon Ram, remember Rabbi Shimon Vasaska, one of the greatest guys that I knew in yeshiva. I told them off, you should know later, when in Israel we would get together. I said, you made the greatest mistake of your life leaving Israel. He would have been a chief rabbi in one of the cities. He was a fabulous speaker of Hebrew. And he said, all right. He said, all right. But he was doing something right because all his children live in Israel. Baruch Hashem. So Rav Shimon Ram and Rav Shmuel Belkin shared a bedroom. They weren't rich enough to buy two beds. They bought one bed, one night one slept on the bed, one on the floor, the next night they reversed. They had one coat that they shared and one pair of shoes. This is the poverty which Rav Shmuel Belkin and Rav Shimon Ram grew up with and under. Rabbi Belkin comes to America, Rabbi Belkin, the young Rabbi Belkin, comes to America not knowing a word of English. He has an aunt in Windsor, Ontario, comes to New York in 1929, comes into the yeshiva, and Rabbi Revel falls in love with him. Tells him, just like Rabbi Leventhal had told him a generation earlier, you need a secular education. And as we said Saturday night, this greenhorn, and I've seen letters that he wrote in his early years in America where he couldn't spell a word correctly, a few years later, has a PhD from Brown University. His PhD is later published by Harvard University. And mid-30s, appointed to the yeshiva faculty, then appointed a professor of Greek and Latin in the college. When they organized in 37 a graduate school for scientific Jewish study, which today is called the Bernard Revel Graduate School, Professor Belkin is the first dean. He was a beloved Rebbe. Talmidim loved him. He loved Talmidim. He loved America. He was so appreciative. His son-in-law said, Eidut Ne'emana, testified that Rav Shmuel Belkin, you know, when television began, it would end about 12 o'clock, and it would end with the Star Spangled Banner. I still remember when I came in Aliyah, I don't know today, I don't watch television, I can't watch it, it hurts me to see Jews fighting Jews, but I use the TV if I can every day. I like to watch a Fawlty Towers, something good and stupid, a nice little escape. I got Baruch Hashem, Seinfeld, Baruch Hashem. So Dr. Belkin, when they would sing the Star Spangled Banner, Ralph Schuchalter said, Eight of them are now, that when the TV went to the Star Spangled Banner, Dr. Belkin, in his pajamas and in his shtekshich, would stand up for the duration of the singing of God Save the Queen, the Star Spangled Banner. Got it? That's Dr. Belkin. That's America. He was a youngster, dean of the yeshiva. He brought Jerry's grandfather, as we said Saturday night, into the faculty. He brought the European in. But he was a kid. Figure out his age, born 1911, we're talking 1941. There was a tremendous battle for the presidency. Two candidates, Mori Urebi, Harav Yosef Dov, Halevi Soloveitchik, and one of the three great rabbis in New York. Rabbis, and if you've studied my book, you can't just read my book, some of that has to be studied. But if you've studied it, the Rub speaks about the three big ones. Remember, rabbis Goldstein, Lookstein, and Young. Goldstein, if I can characterize them as Rabbi Salanter of Israel, the priest, Goldstein was the fluma. He was the tzaddik. Lookstein was the speaker. Young was the most learned. Rabbi Dr. Leo Young, what a battle. The cynic said, if Rabbi Soloveitchik is elected, there's no college left. And if Rabbi Young is elected, Ayeka, there's no yeshiva left. And they battled for 3 years. Could you imagine how we have to be thankful for what God does for us? Could you imagine Tova Lichtenstein? I have to quote myself, I'm quoting Tova now. Tova says, if my father had been elected president of the yeshiva, it would have been the end of his spiritual life. Could you imagine what would have happened? Thank God, it was a standoff. In 1943, the board of directors saw this can't go on indefinitely, so as a compromise, they took a dark horse, Rabbi Dr. Samuel Belkin. Turned out to be an unbelievable choice. 1945, Rav Shmuel Belkin had to give up teaching and stop altogether. Rabbi Revel taught. He had a stroke in November of 40, in the middle of the shiur, in Chosh Mishpat, on a postgraduate level to rabbis who already had smicha. Rabbi Belkin continued to teach for 2 years, but then the burden of yeshiva was too overbearing. 45, he got university status for the yeshiva. What he did is indescribable. He took what was built before him and he expanded it on a graduate school at an American level. Rabbi Belkin would always say, until now we have been the guests of America. Now America will be our guests. And he opened up many graduate schools. Many are still on the map. Most have succeeded. But there's one graduate school he opened which changed the face of the medical profession in the United States. It may be one of his greatest achievements. It's 1953. He organizes Albert Einstein Medical School, got Albert Einstein to lend his name. There's a famous picture of Rabbi Belkin and Dr. Einstein speaking to each other and laughing. And until then, there were quotas, because to be a doctor, Dr. Hoffman, I've got the cup, you have to have a good head. I always tell the story of my brother, my brother, who's a few years younger than I am. So he was a Talmud of Double Lushes, the Tzuvaka. And the Tzuvaka used to press him, be like your brother, study for the rabbinate, be a Talmud Chacham. Time and again, he got it from the Tzuvaka. The day he told the Tzuvaka he's going in Talmud Einstein, the Tzuvaka grabbed him, 2 hands held onto him, and he told him, until now, you could make a mistake in learning. It's not a tragedy, you know, you make a mistake, so you can correct yourself. But a doctor, if he makes a mistake, you won't have a chance to correct yourself. Be very careful and very studious in what you study. So, you know, they had a quota of Jewish boys. Albert Einstein broke the quota because they cornered the market on good Jewish minds. And ultimately, Harvard and Yale, and you can name U of P and any famous medical school in America, the quota was gone. And today, when you see the medical profession in America, as I mentioned just last night, I mean, I was in Cleveland, the whole Cleveland medical industry, the directors, beards, kippah. You go to Los Angeles, you find a shawada, there isn't a famous doctor, the top heart doctor is Danny Vogelander. He's a little younger than you. But remember Danny Vogelander? You know the family. He's a doctor's doctor. I saw people revere him. Doctors, like I revere the Rabbi Lichtenstein. You follow? But Israel, Baruch Hashem, the Einstein graduates, my brother, of course, went up in Israel, was already came right before the Yom Kippur War. He was already operating on soldiers injured in the southern front. We were already in Israel just a few weeks, and he was working already saving lives. So Rabbi Belkin, on the level of Albert Einstein, did something fabulous. But he did more than that. And every woman in the world who opens up a sefer of Limudei Kodesh owes a vote of thanks to Rabbi Belkin. Essentially, we all do things for our children. Rabbi Revel opened Yeshiva College when he did because he had 2 sons who had to go to college. Rabbi Soloveitchik opened Maimonides when he did because he had children who had to go to a day school. Rabbi Belkin had basically only 1 child, a daughter. There was a son, but health problems from birth, congenital, and a very sad story. But the daughter needed a school. In 1948, he organized in Brooklyn Central Yeshiva High School for girls. The first basic elite in the United States, the first high school program for girls. The elementary schools, elementary based Gotham, but this was a school on a level. Rabbi Lichtenstein's father taught there. Rabbi Lichtenstein's mother taught there. And that school took off. Then there was a branch in Manhattan. So you had, just as BTA and MTA, you had Brooklyn Central and Manhattan Central. How many thousands upon thousands of women were educated? And then the process repeated itself. If you have a high school, why do the girls have to go to Barnard, to Columbia, to City College, to Queens College, to Brooklyn College, to Radcliffe? Why can't they go to a college under Yeshiva's auspices? And a German refugee to America by the name of Max Stern, who made a fortune out of food for birds, right or wrong, Hartz Mountains. He endowed Stern College in memory of his parents. It opened in 1954. And what you have in Stern College, we have at least one graduate here, maybe there are more in the audience, but how Stern College expanded, and the level of learning, and the level of Yirat Shemayim. The overwhelming majority of graduates of Stern College have remained not only frum, but dedicated, believe the nefesh, to Torah Hashem. And I have many stories, people I met, and you understand, a Haredi education is not for everyone. I have a dear student in Hollywood, Florida, who just helped me with a very difficult shayla. I think I mentioned I had to track down what happened in Winnipeg, Canada in 1922, 1923. This was Dinei Nefashot. This was not a Yom Tov Sheni shayla. And my student, ultimately it turned out the 94-year-old man he got with every morning was the man I needed from Winnipeg. His wife, father, a rabbi in South America, sent her off to Beis Yaakov, Sephardic girl, ready to leave religion. Came into Stern College, Azat Sadeket, Habuch Nochnish Gizan, and my Nasolabi, what this woman became. Wow. The learning, the feminism quest. Rabbi Lam's own granddaughter learns in the Kollel in Stern College, so Rabbi Lam told me, he walked in, it was about 5 years ago, he says to the girls, "So do you want to be rabbis?" And the girls say, "What are you talking about? We're from, we just want to learn." And his granddaughter says, "Grandpa, you always taught me that a Jew can only be a good Jew if he's learned. We want to be learned. We have graduate school degrees. Why can't we be learned?" But we're from girls. We're not revolutionaries. And Rabbi Lam had a lot of nachat. And Stern College, the outflow, the influence on the Israeli institutions, you understand, is influence going back and forth. Rabbi Belton built this wall. But look what's happening. You have a yeshiva, and you have to give credit to yeshiva university. The yeshiva has remained the foundation of the school. Not like Princeton, not like Yale, not like Harvard. That all began as seminaries for ministers, and you know what they are today, and yeshiva, with all that built, with all that expanded, it remained a great yeshiva, a great Rosh Yeshiva. Both institutions functioned independently. This is a very, very important point. This was not Germany, there was not an outline, there was not a blueprint, there was not an architectural drawing, it was more of an evolvement. And the secular part of yeshiva, or the general part, cannot mix into the yeshiva. But the yeshiva part cannot mix into the college. Jerry and I went to college, and by the way, this is no different. With all the swing to the right, it is no different. We had teachers. Did you ever take English literature? We won't mention the names of some of the professors. Do you remember Lanoff, and there was another guy, Fleischer? They cursed like drunken sailors. Fleischer. He would curse Dr. Belkin and curse this one. There were others. Beowulf turned into an entire sexual drama. All their minds, it was mind-boggling to hear these lectures that they were so focused on sex, they saw nothing else in literature. These law professors said, doesn't matter. You go to college, it has to be college. You have to be prepared for the world. I'll tell you a little story with the Rav. This happened twice that I know of. Once when I was a student, and once it was my students. One of the things we would study is Greek mythology. You know, I don't have to tell you what Greek mythology is. And they went to the Rav. Every 10 years, a committee would go to the Rav. Rabbi Soloveitchik, it is a disgrace for the yeshiva that we have to study Greek mythology. So the Rav would say to them, gentlemen, the reason you go to college is to learn what the Western world is about and to be able to live and function in the Western world. Without Greek mythology, you cannot understand the Western world, and with that, Rabbi Soloveitchik would kick them out. Gentlemen and ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you the greatest gift I got as an American citizen, and as an Israeli citizen, I have a feeling it applies here too. Without Greek mythology, how can you understand what goes on? The great leaders in Greek mythology, they were thieves, they were robbers, they were seducers, they were rapists, right or wrong. You all see the paintings in the beautiful museums here. This is fabulous. Now you can understand how we have presidents of Bill Clinton, President of the United States, will ask Jennifer Flowers to come forth and testify. And that other woman, what was her name? She lives here in London today, a Jewish woman. We find her mother down there, Monica. We find her mother. How could Israel, our prime minister, do I have to tell you about his track records? Remember, my brother operated many times with the husband of the woman, etc., etc. No, without Greek mythology, you can't understand it. Elu Elohecha Yisrael, if the kings can do it, the leaders can do it, the presidents can do it, the population feels great. If they can do it, we can do it. Baruch Hashem, Shalom al Yisrael. And we live like a bunch of animals, primitive monkeys jumping on trees. So, but this is a very important point. Now, time has marched on, and something very fascinating has happened. Rabbi Lamm became president after Dr. Belkin, and Rabbi Lamm did a tremendous job in stabilizing the yeshiva financially. By the mid-70s, the yeshiva was actually bankrupt. And Bowery Bank, which ran ads with Joe DiMaggio, if you recall, he was their spokesman, was ready to foreclose the yeshiva. Rabbi Soloveitchik intervened, and there was a fellow named Sheldon Sokol, and Sheldon put together the package that redeemed yeshiva, and Rabbi Lamm deserved a lot of credit for holding the yeshiva together. The yeshiva continued to expand. Rabbi Lamm guided the yeshiva in the post-Rabbi Soloveitchik period, as we've said many times already. We came out of it a lot better than Lubavitch has come out of its trauma following the Rebbe's demise. By the way, I was at the funeral, and I didn't open the coffin, but I'm quite certain that they carried out the Rebbe was in. When Rabbi Lamm stepped down, for the first time, yeshiva appointed an administrator, not a rabbinic figure. Richard Joel, who had achieved prominence as the head of Hillel, himself a TA graduate, Talmudical Academy graduate, Richard Joel has become the new president of yeshiva. I believe he's already in the sixth or seventh year. And because Richard Joel is fascinating, the only major stream, as they say in Limud, that has a rabbinic personality as president is Hebrew Union College, the Reform. David Ellison, I told you, has smicha, his wife has smicha, or whatever they had. And he's written, it's fascinating, I have an inscribed copy from David Ellison, who knows all my scholarship. He did a doctorate on Rebbe Zriel Hildesheim. That's an interesting guy. And I understand he was influenced by Rabbi Nathan Bumin, who was a yeshiva graduate who brought him to some level of Yiddishkeit. The only rabbi that I think of a major institution, the Reform movement, Ellison, the conservative movement, turned to an American Jewish sociologist, turned to Arnold Eisen, and Arnold Eisen became the head of JTS. It's a fascinating development on the American scene. The budgets have risen so, Yeshiva University functions on a $500 million operating budget a year. And the Balabatim explained to me, I know many of the leaders, many of them are my own devotees, and they're key businessmen. And they all explained to me, we don't need a rabbi, we don't need a professor. We need someone who can administer and inspire, keeping the budget in the black and running a massive institution, a $500 million budget. Yeshiva today is caught up in many cross currents. It is not immune from what's happening all over the world and happening in America. And I'll end off with two examples that, with these examples, you get a feeling of what's going on in yeshiva. One example is from a year ago, and one example we've already alluded to, it's from a few weeks ago. A year ago, there was a tremendous tragedy in Mumbai. You all are aware of it. The whole world suffered. The Chabadnikim, the siege, the little boy that survived, it riveted the entire Israeli population to the news, what was happening in Mumbai. I, for one, am a great chassid of Chabad on that level because I have one son-in-law who does a lot of traveling for the Israeli government. He's been all over the world, and wherever he goes, the first thing he does is contact the local Chabad, and they make all the arrangements for Kashrut and Shabbat. So I can appreciate Mumbai. At Yeshiva University, every year, Chabad runs a Yeshiva University Shabbat. It's a Shabbat where the lecturers, everything is geared to the type of student who's studying at Yeshiva University College in Yeshiva. Every year, 20, 30 guys go, no one pays attention. After Mumbai, 140 students registered. There was an explosion in the yeshiva. My colleagues on the other side of the ocean, Rabbi Meir Twesky, who's the Tona Rebbe, Rabbi Soloveitchik's son-in-law, got up and asked, forbade any student going, Chabad is apikursiv, quote, end quote. My colleague, Rabbi Heschel Shechter, came out in public, Chabad is apikursiv. My colleague, I know these people intimately, Rabbi Mordechai Willig, Chabad is apikursiv. Yeshiva was shaking. Ultimately, 40 kids backed off, 100 went, so you can either say these 40 guys are the only B'nai Torah, or the 40 guys are a bunch of nuts. Take it either way. When my colleagues came to Grus, and ultimately Rav Shechter, and I really get there at least once a year because yeshiva sends them to speak to the kids on the one-year program, the various yeshiva, the Yavin, Shalavim, and Akoto, Netivaye, etc., to try to influence the children to come back and study at Yeshiva College. So I took them on in public, in the base medrash, in front of all our students, and the debate was livid. And I said, Messianus or Wemsi? But every Chabadnik is a Messianist. And I said to Rav Shechter, and I said, oh, Rebbe, you gay. I didn't give it to him. I said, I raised a serious issue. I said, Rav Heschel, one half of the OU rests on your shoulders. The two mashgichim, the two rabbanim poskim for the OU, Rabbi Belsky of Torah Vadas, and Rabbi Shechter of Yeshiva University. All right? And they're giants of learning and psalm. I said, if you parcel out Lubavitch, what's going to be with the OU? Are you willing to live in Shanghai? Are you willing to live in Canada? You know that there are 50 plants in China that are under the oak view. Who gives the hashgacha? Who gives the hashgacha in Thailand? Who goes out with the fishing boats with the tuna? To make a long story short, many months later, a Peshel of Mitterrand was right. He spoke with Rav Menachem Ganev, the head of the Yoyim Kashrut, and Rav Menachem got told him, if we as a Chabad, we can close the Yoyim down. But the world was shaking and still shakes. I don't believe the others changed their minds. Rabbi Willett told me, yes, this Rabbi, do you believe the Rebbe's Mashiach? And the Chabadnik in the Riverdale said to him, why do you ask me a personal question? All right. But on that basis, I wouldn't parcel out all of Kabbalah. That was one issue, but it shows you some of the atmosphere at yeshiva today. The homosexual issue was overwhelming because there was a counter-reaction to the swing to the right. You all have heard of Chovevei Torah. Chovevei Torah has engendered issues, this is Rabbi Avi Weiss, that rebound to yeshiva proper. And when you had this conference at Worthwhile, one of the graduate schools, and you had the Mashgiach of the yeshiva, Rabbi Jerry Blau, and you have Dr. Pelkowitz, wow, and homosexuals are speaking in public, two of the three with their name, one of them related to someone you saw before your eyes in the documentary on the Rav. It's a frightening situation. Of course, then there was a rally against it. The Jerusalem Post had a field day. One week the lead article was on the conference. The next week the lead article was on the rally that was opposed. But La'ihudim hayta ola v'simcha. And this is why you. It's a very open institution. There are multifaceted influences there. It's not mi'ar echad. It's not the way the Haredi world lives, where they clone students, there's a lot of independence. We attempt to teach students to think. There are many different viewpoints. An intelligent student learns and makes his choices. But this is the history of YU. I'll talk in a second with a little bit about Torah. This is the history. It begins in 1886. It evolves. Two men had tremendous influence in giving us the structure that we have today, Rabbis Revel and Belkin. It is a living organism. There is difficulty at times, there's machloket at times, but what an institution. And I conclude, Rabbi Revel, some merited quote from Rabbi Revel, I did not know this quote for the first edition of my doctorate, Rabbi Revel Duliv American Jewish Orthodoxy, but in the second and third edition, you will find it. The only problem is it's not indexed. There are two editions that I made, but the index, of course, was not changed, and the pagination was not changed. But Rabbi Revel said a fabulous concept. He said, we have Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, but yet it's only from Yaakov Avinu that the Jewish people succeed. The Shiftei Kah, the 12 tribes, we who are sitting here. Chazal Rei say, the Mut Yaakov, the Medrash Rabbah, Chakuka al Kisei HaKavod. Yaakov Avinu was the one enthroned on God's chair. Why was Yaakov privileged? And Rabbi Revel said, what was the greatness of Abraham? Gemilat Chesed. Eshel in Be'er Sheva, helping the wayfarer, the angels, food, drink, lodging. Yaakov Avinu, these were the German Jews who came to America. They specialized in Gemilat Chesed. They built hospitals, they built hayas, they did relief work. Who is Yitzchak Avinu? The symbol of prayer. Going up to God, pure worship. These were the Polish Jews who arrived in America. They built Elish Stiblach on the east side of New York, and in its heyday, they say they were run to 300 different Stiblach in an area no bigger than Hendon or Golders Green. But Yaakov Avinu, the Yaakov Ishtam, the man who never left the tent of Torah, the man who studied so many years with Shem Ve'eva, he was the epitome of teaching and studying Torah. These were the Litvisha white Russian Jews who came to America. They built Torah. Yaakov Avinu, when you teach Torah, the Jewish people thrive. They built the first Torah institution in America. As a result of Etz Chaim and Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, Torah thrives in America. And this is why we finally succeeded in America, because we followed the course of Yaakov Avinu. And may the Ribbono Shel Olam give us the strength to go further. Lahagdil Torah ulahagdira. Thank you very, very much.
Tomorrow night is the last.